I'm Eliza Skinner on the BBC World Service, and this is On the Podium, where the best of Paralympic and Olympic sport are put through their paces by the BBC's athletics commentator, Ed Harry, and Paralympian Scout Bassett. And I try to hide the fact that I have never run a steeplechase or done a steeplechase. I don't know what a steeplechase is. That's my qualifications here. Okay, today's question, classiest question, very Hollywood. Who's the most famous person you guys have ever met?
I think the most famous person I've met is Usain Bolt.
Oh, I've met him. Ah. I raced him.
Did you? Oh, now tell us about this, because I've only ever interviewed him.
Yeah, I raced him when I was working on a late night show. He was a guest, and we did a bit where he raced the entire staff. Spoiler, he beat me.
No.
I believe he beat everybody. Yes. But yeah, what about you, Scout? Is it you? Are you the most famous person you've met?
No. But I was trying to think outside of sports, and I don't have any outside of sports. So the most famous athletes I've ever met, Serena Williams, and that was just recently. She was quite lovely. And I've met her twice, and I forgot about the first time that I met her. The first time I met her was in college, and I worked at the U.S. Open as the court attendant on Arthur Ashe.
What does a court attendant do?
The court attendant is the person that like sets up the athlete's locker room stuff and then on-court stuff. So you know how Nadal needs to have his towel on a certain side. I think it's like the right side or whatever.
You're like the court butler.
Yes.
Can you remember what Serena Williams's one was? What did she ask for? Is it like loads of special stuff or just...
Yes, she had one request, and this is a hilarious story. So this was my first big match, and I'm so nervous. Like, I am like sweating, and I can't sleep for 2 days leading up to this. And so I get the sheet, and everything seemed kind of normal, certain number of towels, this and that. And then on the sheet, it said purple Gatorade. She wants her cooler filled with only purple Gatorade. And she's warming up, and like 20 minutes before the match, she opens the cooler, and I see she has a very upset look on her face. So she comes over to me, and she says, "I asked for purple Frost Gatorade."
Oh, that's more than one sort.
Not the same thing as regular purple Gatorade.
I almost asked halfway through this story, when you said the purple Gatorade, I was like, well, wait, which purple Gatorade? Like, aren't there a few tones? There's like a lavender, which would be the Frost. I prefer the Frosts myself because they don't even try to be a real flavor. It's just like, what's this? It's the flavor of Arctic Wind. And I'm like, sure, that's what this tastes like. So anyway, ugh, that's nerve-wracking.
So she says, it's 20 minutes before the match. This better be filled with purple Frost Gatorade before the match starts, or else I will tell your supervisor. I'm like, I'm getting fired. This is my first big match. Like, I'm like, my life is over. I have messed up the one thing that she must have, right? Anyways, we got it to her in time, minutes to spare. Funny enough, when I saw her in November, I was like, you probably don't remember me, but I met you at the US Open. And funny enough, she's like, I remember that I asked you to change what was in my cooler. And she's like, you got it in time.
Oh, she did remember. Wow.
Well, I mean, I don't think there were a lot of court attendants that had a prosthetic. So she did remember. But it was just so funny. So I would say she's definitely one of them.
Like, your story, Scout, reminded me of when I was working in a hotel in New York. And one day my job was I had to run all over New York trying to find an all white, brand new, never before used tea set for Pete Townsend, because he would not use a tea set that someone else had used before.
Rock and roll.
Right? Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Go nuts.
Stick that to the man. Where's my new China?
Yeah. Yeah. No designs on it. It's got to be all white. But yeah, as far as the most famous, I've worked with so many random weird people. I've taught a lot of people how to rap, and Shaq loves me.
You've met Shaq.
That's impressive.
I love him.
I've met Shaq a few times and legit, oh he does God. Like me. You can Google me. Google Eliza Skinner, Shaquille O'Neal. We met on his TV show and one of his co-hosts was being rude to me on air. And so I gave it back to him and Shaq liked that quite a bit.
Is he as fun?
He's fun. He physically picked me up. It was like being picked up by a dinosaur. He is huge. He picked me up and carried me around the studio after I like dressed down this other dude on the show. And he was like, winner, she's the winner. Right, let's get on the podium. Who's with us this week, Ed?
Our guest today is a gold medal winning sprinter. He won 100 meters gold for Norway at the Tokyo Paralympic Games in his classification for athletes with a visual impairment. In winning that gold, he broke his own world record. Back home, he's a maths teacher. His own childhood was about surviving. Born in DR Congo, his family fled the civil war there and settled in Norway to start a new life. Salem Koshafali, welcome to On the Podium.
Thank you very much, sir. Appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
We're so glad to have you. We're going to be looking at some pictures from your life, and Ed will be describing them as they come up and sort of use that to guide our conversation. Sound good?
Yeah, sound good.
Great. So, Ed, what's our first photo?
We're called On the Podium, Salem, and this is a shot of you wearing your mask, as everybody had to in Tokyo at the Olympics and the Paralympics. You've got the gold medal around your neck, and you've got one arm raised to the sky and one finger pointing high into the sky as well. And the other shot we have, which has got to be seen in tandem with the podium picture, is you pointing at the trackside clock, saluting your own brand new world record. 10:43 was the time you won in, which is world class in Paralympic sport and indeed in Olympic sport too. What were your emotions, firstly, on the podium? You're raising one arm to the sky and you're pointing. Is that saying I'm number one?
That was symbol of many things. It's like from zero to hero. And yes, I'm number one because I worked so hard to earn my gold medal and the world record and to be where I am.
Why were you starting at zero?
I came from the lowest life you can imagine yourself, like the really lowest of the lowest. I came for a place where I have to beg for food or just steal food. So from a person like me to qualify to Paralympic and a slight chance to come to the final and a slight chance to get a gold medal, from that little child for me to come to Norway and win a gold medal, that's basic for me, zero to hero.
So in that moment, you were feeling sort of that whole journey.
Yeah, I saw the whole journey through my head was on the podium. I couldn't believe it. It was amazing, so I had to enjoy the moment because it took me quite a long time to be there.
Yeah, take that moment.
Yeah.
How did you find out about the Paralympics? Because you're sort of new in terms of the international scene.
I have always heard about Paralympics, but my focus was always to try to make the able body because the world was number two, number three in all race. I was trying to make it able body. So when I went from like 80% to 2% visions, just like my life was just a wreck. And I quit the track and field. I didn't want to play any sport anymore. But 1 year after that, my early coach came to me and said, let's try Paralympics. You can still compete with everybody. Paralympics is the way to go. You can show people that disability is ability. So he presented it to me and then we took it from there.
I mean, you were good. We should make this point. You were on the verge of representing Norway internationally. You won the national 60 meters title indoors in 2015. How difficult, though, was it as you began to lose your sight to see the Paralympics as a pathway? Because it you seem to be saying that you were kind of done with track and field for a while if you couldn't do it the way you'd originally wanted to do it.
No, because to lose my vision rapidly as it did is one of my darkest moments I can say in my life, because I couldn't visualize me doing athletics. I couldn't visualize me engaging in the community. I could barely like go to the shop and buy milk or couldn't recognize people's faces around me. So I was just focusing on how to function in this society. But with time and then a lot of work with myself and talk to my coaches and my family, it helped me see things in different ways.
So it wasn't just a loss of your eyesight. It was also a loss of all of your plans and the entire way you had wanted to live your life.
Yeah, yeah. I lost my job because they said to me that I couldn't do the job properly because I lost my vision. You know, like everything disappeared for that 1 year.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, what was the job? Because I bet whoever said you can't work with me anymore, they must look back on that now and just think, I was on the wrong side of this.
Yeah, you can say that again. It was actually the same job that I do, only different school, you know?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was the same job that I did, only different schools. So I told him, like, I'm not blind in my mind. I just need to think differently. So sadly, I had to let me go. And the person that let me go has since come and apologized to me and talked about it and then forget about it. And then I forgave him. So he didn't know any better. Disability comes from limitations.
Mm-hmm.
Disability mm-hmm. comes, society just put a mark on people that you just, if I'm disability, then just put a mark on me that I cannot do my work properly. That's making me disability, helping me to do the work that I know I can do.
So the limitation can come from inside, or it can come from society, from the community, yeah. is what you're saying. Yeah. And that's anyone it. can be limited by their community.
Yeah. And if your expertise are not being used to the fullest at your work, that's mm-hmm. that's form of disability, I think. Mm-hmm.
Being a teacher, especially a high school math teacher, is quite a demanding job. There's not a lot of off days or time. So I'm curious, how were you able to balance, incorporate your training and competition schedule with being a teacher?
I work only 3 days a week now.
Okay.
Now I've just started for February. So I just have to make a good system around me with my coaches with my colleagues around me. The most difficult in my days is not the training or the job, but everything around me that I have to be focused on. Just taking a bus through town, go through town, take another bus. But that's the thing that takes a lot of energy out of me. But I do want to work because it's making an impact on my students to do better at school and sports, and it makes me a better person when I see a student do good and after that go to training and say, if this student can do this today, I can do even better.
What did your students think?
Yeah, they were super proud of me. So when I came back to school, I was like hundreds and hundreds of students who was waiting for me and cheering me on. And they wanted to see the gold medal. They wanted to take a picture. And like, well, do you know it was this fast? Do you know it was so good?
Did they try a little harder in class? Did the averages go up?
I got a little more respect.
When your math teacher gets a gold medal, you kind of have no excuse to turn your homework in late. Right?
Maybe.
This is me being stupid, I'm sure, but I think of like track and field and just athletics in general, and it feels like such a visceral thing. And then math feels like such a deeply mental thing. They seem like two different extremes of a person. Does it feel like that to you, or are they connected somehow for you? It just seems like such interesting things to be very good at.
You know, I became a math teacher, not by choice, to be honest. Oh, okay.
They made you do it. They forced you.
Because I didn't know how to write. I couldn't write my name until I was 14 years old. You know,
wow.
I couldn't read. I couldn't do anything of that. So by me being a teacher, also be a dream of mine. And I want to still be a teacher even when I lost my sight. So even I couldn't be the subject that I was hoping to be, I need to take another path. And for taking that, I need to work harder in math. I need to love math and I need to be fully committed to solve all the problem and not give up.
So the math was an arranged marriage, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, how many languages do you speak?
I speak French and Swahili, Lingala, English, and Norwegian.
Wow.
Wow.
I speak English. I got to start working harder. Okay.
But I'm lucky. You know, if I was born in Norway, I probably just would have spoken Norwegian and English.
I like as well that apart from saying to your students, I'm your teacher, you should listen to what I'm saying. You can say, I'm a gold medalist, you should listen to what I'm saying. And you can say, and because of how I grew up and because I was a refugee and I started school in Norway really late, I did all of my learning in just a few short years. So yet another reason why you guys should work hard in my classes.
Yeah, I don't quite say that, but it's similar to that, you know. I just want to tell them that, like, working hard, you're in a great position, you know, where I'm coming from. We don't have it. So take advantage of it, because if you don't, like, someone else out there who wish to be in position. And I was one of them, so.
You are in the T12 classification for the visually impaired. That is the middle of the three visually impaired classes, which means that you have the option to have a guide or no guide. What challenges does your visual impairment present for you in terms of being able to gauge where you are in the race? And can you tell us what you're able to see and not see when you're in the lane?
Things I don't see, it doesn't exist for me, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah. It makes it easier for you to run your own race, probably.
Yeah, in some way. When I run, it does make some challenge. But usually what I do before an 100-meter competition, I walk the lane forth and back, like, I don't know, 5-6 times, trying to, like, feel where I am every 20 meters, every 30 minutes to feel if I'm there yet. Because sometimes when I run 100 meters with everybody, I turn to dip too early or it's a lot of people around me. So I get distracted and scared to run somebody down. it hasn't happened yet, but it's a fear that I have. For example, Norwegian Championship, I got second place, you know, but I was so far ahead. I was unsure where I was, so I have to slow down to not run in somebody. So what I see is just some stripes on the side and the finish line, like 1 meter before I'm there.
Do I understand you correctly that sometimes you just get worried that you might be running into someone and so you pull back a little bit? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, that I do that sometimes with everybody. So it's a little bit safe for me when I run T12, because the lane is empty, so I get to focus on myself. That helps me a little bit, actually. I hope one day in the future that some top athlete in the world can retire and be my guide.
I mean, it's going to take that, isn't it? Because we've said you're in the middle of these three visual impairment classifications, and it's a congenital condition, and it could potentially get worse, and then you may have to run with a guide runner, but they are going to have to be serious international class, aren't they? Because you are already incredibly quick, so quick that you're racing in national champs against people without a disability in Norway. And you would make a lot of people's national teams right now with the times you run for the Olympics, let alone the Paralympics. So have you kind of got your eye on a sprinter one day? You think, come over here, you've just retired. We need to pair up.
Yeah, definitely, that is something that I'm getting faster and faster. I'm faster than ever. So I'm hoping in a few years that some retired top athlete can come here and let's do this together to take out your full potential.
You're listening to On the Podium with me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry. Norway's Salem Kashefale is the fastest Paralympian on earth and is today's guest.
Ed, do we have another photo?
We do. We've seen you on the podium, Salem, but the next couple of pictures are really about family. There's you with your snap baseball cap on backwards. You've got your medal around your neck and your father is with you. He's looking at the medal. It looks like perhaps he or you is placing the medal around your neck. He looks very proud. And in the second shot, your father is giving you a big embrace, a huge hug. I mean, you you touched on it really briefly, your childhood, scavenging, trying to survive, trying to stay alive in DR Congo. We talk a lot about people having journeys in their life, but for you and your family, it was an actual physical journey, wasn't it? You didn't just leave DR Congo one day and then go to Norway the next day. I mean, what was that period of time like, and why is family and celebrating what you did with your family so important?
Oh God, I don't know where to start. Family means a lot to me in many ways, but especially since we have been through a lot. Place that I grew up in called Goma, 7 out of 10 people hear gunshots, you know, is quite normal. But this particular day when we were sleeping, my father came into our room and just woke us up and said the war is finally here, so we have to escape. So if we stay, we're definitely going to die. And if we go outside, we have slight chance to survive. So what we did, we went out, opened the door, and people are running all over the place. People are flying. People are falling down like flies, you know. You walk outside the door, you see your friends, you see grandma lay down or dead, and you're holding your brother. Suddenly he just fell down and dead. So you're waiting for the moment that it's going to be your turn. And for the next 3 weeks, we were on the road and escaping. We didn't have any water, any food. We saw a lot of people be shot in front of you, pretty dramatic. And to come safe out of it with some of my siblings, to live in a refugee camp for like almost 1 year, where we almost lost their life. I lost one brother in there. I myself was about to die. My father was about to die. So to come to Norway is like winning a lotto. Like it's like 1 in a million chances for us to come to Norway. So for me to be able to just have a roof, food, we're most happy peace people in the world. So for me going to Paralympic and get that gold medal, that's prime moment for my family because they know what we and I have been through.
So the first win was just getting to Norway.
That was the first win, and we didn't need anything else. But just that was all.
So I would imagine you're an important member of a few different communities, Norway, Congo, Paralympic. What did this win mean to all of those communities? What kind of reaction did you get?
Most of the reaction I got was very positivity. I got a lot of messages from people from Congo that messaged me and said it was proud of me. I felt when I come to Norway with the gold medal, the king of Norway actually called me on my phone.
He makes phone really calls?
I didn't know he did that, you know?
I feel like it should be like a hawk or something. Or should ride up on a horse. I don't know.
And so he was like, yeah, telling me that he part of me and a lot of people tell me about a part of me. That make me feel like people can come from nothing to something and be something. And Norway have been so good to me. I take good care of me and made me feel like home, even though I'm born in Congo. So it's a win for both of them, but mostly it's a win for my family and myself.
It's a small country. What was the response? Did your life change when you went back home? Did people recognize you on the streets in Bergen? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
A lot of people did recognize me and do recognize me. Everything is still the same for me. I still work hard every day.
I wanted to just follow up on that. I've spent a bit of time in Norway, and actually I was just there last fall. I went to Bergen. It's a lovely city, okay. By the way. Yeah, beautiful. But yeah. There's not a lot of people who look like you there. You know, you being a Black athlete representing the Paralympics, do you hope that will inspire or, you know, encourage more people with disabilities in Norway to take up the Paralympics?
That's a good question, though. Bergen have done a great job to present me in the right way. So by me winning Norwegian Championship for everybody in 2019 was a wake-up call for everybody that this is top athlete. We train as hard as anybody else out there with our disability, and we can be as good as them. So that has helped me actually to lift me a little bit, to see Paralympian, inspire people to do more Paralympic, and now continue to do that.
Ed, do we have another photo?
We do. And I think this is one of those moments that maybe happens to you after you've started winning medals. This looks like a television panel show. There's a guy sat down in the middle of a desk. He's bald, he's got a beard, and he's just playing with his tie. You're stood to one side. There are four people stood behind him, and you're one of them. You're laughing. You've got your hands on your hips, and you're really laughing, and everyone else is smiling. So I don't know, is this a TV show you've been on? Is it a TV show you're going back on? And how often are you on television and things like that these days after Tokyo and the gold medal and breaking your own world record?
Wow, that's the most popular comedian show in Norway. It's popular and make funny of a lot of subjects in the community, from the athlete to politicians to everything in society, yeah, really. They call me and then they say, do you want to join our show? I say, I'm not a comedian, I'm an athlete. So I don't think it suits me. And you say, no, come on, just be yourself. Just we give you some punch that you can say out. It was fun to be there. And yes, after Paralympic, it has been a lot of media around me. There's a lot of people who get to invite me to the shows and write some books and a lot of that, but I'm not trying to focus on beyond everything. I'm trying to still have the focus that I had before all this happened, and that is to train hard, stay focused, be dedicated, and then have my goal.
And what are those goals that you have for the present or the future?
Just wake up and be thankful for opportunity to be awake, opportunity to have food on my table, thankful to my family around me and friends, and thankful to have a job. That's the thing that every day when I wake up, I'm thankful. That's like my goal every day, to just to be happy and present. And the future goal is, in terms of track and field, is one thing is better than one medal, and that's two medals, you know.
I think a lot of people might look at your life or elements of your life and think you have plenty of reasons to not be thankful. Why don't you? Why have you found this other direction of being so thankful and focusing on that?
No, I came from a place where we had so little. Mm-hmm. You know, we have so little, but we were really happy and thankful for the thing we have, and we didn't think about what we didn't have, you know, when I lived in Ireland, Congo. But when it comes to a place as Norway, when everything is around you, you know, mm-hmm. the road that me and my family have been through, that I have every reason to be thankful because I'm alive. I could be dead, you know. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people who didn't make it. And I come from a place too when people who have disability are not included in the society, you know, and have opportunities to find my place here. So I have every reason to be thankful. I think people today focus on materialistic things, you know, instead of be thankful for what they have and gain more learning, because what we have in here, we can use it 20, 15, 30 years, but all the things around me will fade, and they'll buy new clothes, buy new shoes, you know, people mm-hmm. buy new houses.
And when you say what we have in here, you mean in your mind, inside of,
yeah,
in my, you know, head, it's, yeah, on the radio. So just had to let the people know you pointed to your head.
I'm sorry.
No. I just think that it's so important, and I want to crack your code and be able to do that too. So that's why I'm like, yes, tell us everything. How this does sound like the right way to live, focusing on all of the things that you do have and adding to that pile of knowledge and experience, it sounds like.
Of course, and that's how I live my life with my disability. What I don't see, I don't think about it, you know. I don't use my energy about it, you know. I'm just focused on what I can see and use that to go around.
I believe you currently hold the title, the fastest Paralympian. I believe you broke Jason Smith's record or title of that at Tokyo. Is that something that you're looking to, as you go to Paris 2024, is there a friendly rivalry with Jason, or are you just looking to put that in the past and to continue to go maybe sub 1040?
One of my big goals in track and field is to compete with Jason Smith, because he's one of the athletes that inspired me.
Who is also visually impaired.
Yeah. So he made me trying, like, wow, that boy can run, you know. I would be that fast. I want to run with him, you know. So by beating the Paralympic record and be a fast Paralympian, yeah, that's a bonus. It's pretty good. Yeah. I wanna be the fastest Paralympic ever. It's no way to Paris. He's trying to break it this year. And when the time comes to Paris, I think I can run sub 10:20.
Wow. Well, it's a blossoming rivalry, and I have no doubt that you're on your way.
If Jason Smith or other athletes do break my records, I would love to break McCann, though.
Exactly.
I still root for them, but I still want to be the fastest. I mean, that I have to work as hard as they do, and then even more.
Thank you so much for talking with us today. We've had a great time.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, he was great. What a very laid back person with an amazing story. It was like, oh yeah, me, I've kind of done everything, had all of the human experiences, no big whoop.
When we're looking at, you know, being a refugee and all of the awful stuff that happened to him and his family, but he didn't really go to school till he was 13.
And, yeah, didn't and learn to write his name till 14.
Yeah, and now he teaches mathematics to high school children whilst also showing them what can be done in international sport and everything else. And look, I've got to say, he is quick. I know people get bored and bogged down with times and everything. He is quick. He would make a lot of national teams with the times he's running for the Olympics, let alone the Paralympics. Some countries, yeah, like the USA, and maybe here in the UK, that overall standard is slightly higher, but he's very close where he is to saying, I could be there at an Olympics if he wanted to, and he could have that conversation with the IOC. But just to see how talented he is and everything he's come out of to get where he's got to already in his life and in his career is fantastic.
And that he only took up track at 17. It's not like he's been running through grade school years that's relatively late in the world of sprinting, especially for able-bodied athletes, competing with able-bodied athletes.
Thinking about the differences in the way that these races have to be run for able-bodied and para-athletes, with the extra room in the lanes, correct, for para-athletes, is there any kind of race, maybe this already exists, where like everybody races on their own, like it's one at a time, and then you compare the times?
I mean, you lose the spectacle, but it would be it would be nice to see him flat out, because the way he described, I'm just not sure where people are around me. And I've spoken to athletes with a visual impairment that when they first brought in this idea of the little trackside camera that moves on a rail, a para sprinter with a visual impairment said to me, I thought, who's this guy? Because I'm seeing this in my peripheral vision. I've only got peripheral vision. I'm thinking, who is this guy? Because he's right with me. And he goes, he was laughing. He goes, but this is the kind of thing. Because it was a new thing, you know. And Salim talked a lot about, you know, even as he gets from like school to training and all the systems he has in place. I bet if you met him, you wouldn't necessarily realize he had a visual impairment, but that's probably testament to all of the things he has in place. And just because he has to a great extent, an invisible impairment or disability, it doesn't mean that it's any less difficult every day to kind of work around and work through that. But he took it all in his stride, didn't he? The way he was just describing every element. Incredible.
But again, as I was saying, like a pod where each person runs. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, but I'd have to do like eight times as much work. So I'd have to commentate eight separate times.
Oh, it's about you. People.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Now I see.
That would be rough to do, though.
I'm sure you
TV
would lose.
TV perspective. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, that. Well, I was like, my first instinct is you lose the motivation of everybody else running. But if you're visually impaired anyway, isn't that just an advantage that people who aren't visually impaired would have over you? So level of playing field, put everybody in a pod.
I'm really
into pod Olympics now.
I don't know if you're selling it to me or just scaring me into it.
Pod version of each sport. I mean, the way these COVIDs are going, we're going to need pod sports. Well, that's it from me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry. And join us next time for more of this.
What I'm looking at doing is, how can I be better tomorrow? How can I be better in 1 month, 2 months, 12 months? What is the goal? Paris in 2024 is a goal. So what do I need to do to be successful there?
The oldest medalist in Tokyo, we saddle up with Andrew Hoy next time on The Podium.